Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton will be Sir Oswald Mosley, and I will be joined for this episode by my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Shall we move into our Greatest Britons for today then, Max?
Yes, I think that would be a good idea.
Yes, let's talk about one of our Greatest Britons who did actually try to, who could actually see the dangers that were going to happen in the future with multiculturalism and tried to put a stop to it, a Greatest Briton that almost actually became Prime Minister, which I was amazed to discover. I never realised we had nationalists get that close to actually getting hold of power. And we are, of course, talking about Sir Oswald Ernold Mosley, who's actually also a 6th Baronet, who was incredibly popular before the Second World War. And during the Second World War, him and his party, the British Union Fascists, they were arrested, they were put in prison, not against any charges at all. They had no habeas corpus, and we'll talk about what happened there as we get into this. But I think after that, the name that he had, the good name that he had, had been smeared, you know, because he'd been put in prison. And all the while, it was Neville Chamberlain that was Prime Minister. Even though the war had started, I think he was safe. But once Winston Churchill came into power, within 2 weeks, Oswald Mosley and all the British Union Fascists, they'd all been put in prison with no habeas corpus and no charges against them. Now, I've heard of Oswald Mosley. I'd looked into him a bit, but I'd never been a huge fan of Oswald Mosley. It wasn't Oswald Mosley that brought me into nationalism. It was really looking at American stuff, looking at racial statistics, and then looking at revisionist history of the Second World War, and then coming across Oswald Mosley. And I did an interview with somebody in their 90s who was actually a part of Oswald Mosley's party after the Second World War, and he was around during the Second World War. We called him Mr. I, and people can find the interviews with him talking about this particular time period. We've got them on the Radio Albion site, and I believe around about the, I mean, he tried to do things after the Second World War. He tried to get this Europe a nation thing off the ground, and some people said that he was quite visionary as far as the European Union was concerned, but obviously on a different basis than the European Union is today. But I can't recall ever seeing him actually interviewed on the television. I don't think any of my family were big fans of Oswald Mosley or anything like that. But I do know Laura Towler is a huge fan of Oswald Mosley, and he does have a lot of support still within this country. And there was a huge movement of support behind him. Max, do you know? Do you recall seeing him on the television? Were you involved in nationalism at all whilst Oswald Mosley was still alive and active?
I don't have any direct recollections of him campaigning. I think that I was probably too young or perhaps not even born in the sort of early post-war years when he came back and launched it was a union movement that he launched, I believe, in 1948. And that continued to exist through to about 1973, which is where, as you say, he was trying to promote this idea of Europe a nation. And I think that he also was a member during part of that period of an organisation called the National Party of Europe, which is a kind of an international thing. And I know that he did write also for a magazine that was produced by the Italian nationalist organisation. I think the initials are MSI during that sort of period as well. But it was Regulation 18B that resulted in Mosley being put in prison during most of the Second World War. The only time I actually saw him speaking was in an interview, a television interview, and I can't remember who the interviewer was, but the interviewer appeared Weasley by comparison, and Oswald Mosley was spoke with great gravitas. I've seen films of him speaking as a younger man, and he was a very charismatic character, and was a great orator, and introduced a great element of drama into the speeches that he made. And, you know, he wasn't somebody who just stood calmly at a lectern with his hands resting on the lectern, you know, perhaps occasionally flipping a page over. He appeared to have all of his speeches committed to memory, and he used a lot of dramatic hand gestures in order to emphasize his words. And there's a very famous piece of video of him speaking at one of the large meetings that he organized, I think, at Olympia, where he is speaking at his best. But there are other examples of him speaking in various London locations, I think Limehouse was a place where there were quite a large number of Mosley supporters, and there was a very famous speech that I think he made at Limehouse at some point during the days of the British Union of Fascists, that was the organisation that he promoted between 1932 and 1940 before he was arrested under Regulation 18B.
Yeah, I think it's actually a great shame there aren't more recordings of him. I think that's one of the things we're actually lacking is enough recordings of Oswald Mosley speaking. We have lots of text format versions, but if you go looking online, you'll find that there's 2-minute clips of him, things like that. I think there's that one long speech that you're referring to, Max, but there's very little else. There was a very good video documentary that was brought out about him, I seem to recall, a year ago or 2 years back. An excellent video documentary. And obviously, he's featured in historical films of the time, but they always try to portray him in a negative light. And we're actually getting our notes for this. We're getting our notes from Wikipedia. We're also including his own book, My Life, which is his own autobiography. And I've been checking the Wikipedia notes up against what he says in his book. And unsurprising, I guess you could say, the Wikipedia notes are wrong. Some of them have included an incident which is not mentioned at all in his book. I think if he doesn't talk about this and he says the opposite of what the Wikipedia notes are saying, then we have to go with what he is saying, because that's the original documentary source, isn't it, of the time. That was him writing about it. That was his memory. And that's what we should really be going with. But he's obviously still a big influence on today. I mentioned Laura Towler there. She's a big fan of Oswald Mosley. And there's even a resurgence, I think, of the British Union of Fascists. I think they're sort of more like, they like to dress up like it. And I think they're more like a live action role playing organization, but they do obviously support his politics. There's a very good website online, which might be maintained by them. And I think I actually interviewed the chap that was behind this new British Union, but they're obviously not a large organisation, but they are included amongst the nationalist organisations within Britain. But the actual black shirts and the wearing of the black shirts, that was outlawed, and that same law was used against Britain First, I think, at some point. That's really my sort of recollections about him. Do you want to add anything to that, Max, before we get on with the overview of his life?
No, let's press on with the overview. That should be there. Best way forward, I would think.
Okay, well, Sir Oswald Ernold Mosley, the 6th Baronet, was born on the 16th of November 1896, and he died on the 3rd of December 1980, so he had a nice long life there. He was a British politician during the 1920s and the 1930s, who rose to fame when, having become disillusioned with mainstream politics, he turned to fascism. He was a Member of Parliament originally and later founded and led the British Union of Fascists. Now, some people may think, well, isn't that supportive of Italy with Mussolini and his idea of fascism? But fascism itself grew out of corporatism, and it was a nationalist ideology. And even though you had Mosley leading the British Union of Fascists, there were other groups in Britain that were also fascist. You had fascist or nationalists that were in Romania. You also had General Franco that had these sympathies there. So it wasn't a supportive of Italy or anything like that. When people ask about fascism today, I always say, well, the best way to describe a fascist is to look at the fasci. which is the bundle of sticks together. And it, when the bundle of sticks or the bundle of twigs are held together, they're strong enough to be an axe. You can put an axe head in there and you can then chop a log much, much bigger than the twig. So the message that is saying is that you put a group together, all of the same particular type, and they're much stronger than they are as the individuals. And that actually goes all the way back to the fasci symbol, which was used in the Roman Empire. And you also see it today in the United States. I think it's in the Houses of Congress there. You've got two big symbols of fasci on either side. So it shows you that it was seen as an essential, actually an essential part of being European was the fasci. And it was not seen in a negative light right the way up until Mussolini used it as the symbol for his fascism. And at the end of the Second World War, I mean, they still have these fasci that are there on the Congress building in the United States. But I, rather than going into all the details of what fascism is, that's the way that I would look at it. Look at the fasci. That's where the name for the term actually comes from. And you can understand that from that, what, fascism is all about. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Yeah. As far as the fasci symbol is concerned, the bundle of sticks was meant to indicate, people of a single kind bound together, in such a way as to make them stronger. And the axe in the middle was intended to indicate a single leadership authority showing strong leadership. And that was the symbolism of that. But you're quite right. There are lots of buildings. If you go around many of the large buildings in London, but also in other major towns and cities around the UK and indeed around the world, then you will find that there will very often be fasci that will feature in the engravings that are made around the architraves of doors or in the various places architecturally. And it is because there was a reference back to the days of ancient Rome, where there was regarded as where the Roman Empire was regarded as an empire with strong leadership and a leadership that was capable of binding the people together to make them stronger effectively.
So it's beyond the the dictionary definition that you would get of a fascist, and they would try and say that it goes back to Mussolini. Well, it doesn't. It goes back to the symbol, which is, you know, thousands of years old. Well, after military service during the First World War, Moseley was one of the youngest members of Parliament, representing Harrow from 1918 to 1924, first as a Conservative, then as an Independent, before going on to join the Labour Party. At the 1924 general election, he stood in Birmingham Ladywood against the future Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, coming within 100 votes of defeating him. And it was actually only 70 votes. I mean, it's a real tragedy that he didn't actually beat Neville Chamberlain. And I think, we didn't actually have Moseley as Prime Minister. And it's interesting here that we can see that he tried each one of the political parties, the Conservatives, Labour, and as an Independent. And then he formulated his ideology after being an insider in both of those. And I think that also shows us that back then, if you were a nationalist, you weren't necessarily associated with being the right wing or the left wing. It was beyond that. It's only today that it gets called far right. It wasn't a far right thing back then. And as we've talked about with some of our greatest Britons that were social nationalists, if you like, people that were certainly on the left, but they were also nationalists. I forget the name of the fellow who was a big English nationalist. We did a few episodes on him, Max, didn't we? And you had an essay that you'd written on his ideology, and he set up a load of magazines.
Robert Blatchford, you think?
That's it. Yes, Robert Blatchford, because he was definitely on the left. And as we were talking about in the recent eugenics series as well, the people that were supportive of eugenics, they were on the right and they were on the left. So at this time, it wasn't seen as far right, wasn't seen as right wing extremism or anything like that. It was just purely wanting to do the best for your people. And that is the way that all nationalists still are today. Yet I think we get mischaracterized as being far right. And we can see here that, you know, he'd served in the First World War. When we get into the details of that, we will see that he was extremely brave and extremely courageous. Any comments you want to make on that, Max?
Also, he did join the Labour Party in 1926, between 26 and 31, and he became the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster during that period, which is kind of like minister without portfolio. So he was actually a cabinet minister in a Labour government at that time.
Wow, so a cabinet minister as well. Well, he returned to Parliament as Labour MP for Smethwick at a by-election in 1926 and served as Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster in the Labour government of 1929 to 1931. In 1928, he succeeded his father as the 6th Moseley Baronet, a title that had been in his family for more than a century. He was considered a potential Labour Prime Minister, but resigned because of discord with the government's unemployment policies. He chose not to defend his Smethwick constituency at the 1931 general election, instead unsuccessfully standing in Stoke-on-Trent. Moseley's new party, that's what it was called, became the British Union of Fascists in 1932. So it's a great shame, really, that he didn't stick with his Smethwick constituency, to be honest. And it was the government's unemployment policies. I think around about this time, if you look at the unemployment policy in Germany, they managed to get 6 million people back to work who were out of work. And Germany had been completely destroyed after the First World War, and they had to pay back all these debts. We all know about what happened with the Versailles Treaty. And you've got Oswald Mosley, who can see what's happening in Germany. And then here in Britain, you've still got the same mentality is going on, and we're in the middle of a depression, and we've got people walking all the way from Wales to London looking for work. And he can see that the Labour Party are not doing what they should be doing. Max, you want to say something there?
I was just going to say there was the Jero March as well during the 1930s that was against poverty, where people walked all the way from Tyneside down to London as well.
That may have even been the one that I'm thinking of. I just remember being told about this long march that people went on, and Mosley was disillusioned with the Labour Party's policy of dealing with unemployment. He had the same problem in America as well. We had the Great Depression. There was a big depression all around the world. That's why in Germany it was referred to as the economic miracle when everybody was put back to work, and of course that was by the NSDP, it was by the National Socialists there. So then you've got Mosley being interested in that and forming this British Union of Fascists here in Britain, because you can see, you know, the amazing way that Germany was brought back from the brink. Well, then we get to the Second World War, where Mosley was imprisoned without a trial and with no habeas corpus in May 1940 during the war, and the British Union of Fascists was banned. And remember that they were never taken to court, never given a trial, never given even an accusation of what it is that they had actually done. They were just put in prison for the duration of the war. Freed in 1943, Mosley founded the Union Movement, although soon moved abroad in 1951, spending most of the remainder of his life in Paris and two residences in Ireland. He stood for Parliament during the post-war era, but received little support. During this latter period, he was an advocate of pro-European integration and took part in founding the National Party of Europe. He is also known for the influence he had on the thinking of the founders of the Soil Association, a catalyst for the organic farming movement in Great Britain. And that was the first that I'd actually heard about that he had this link with organic farming. And also they leave out here Mosley's idea about economics, which apparently were a huge influence on a lot of people. Even John Major went back to Mosley's ideas about economics to try to solve one of the problems that we had in the 90s. So you would have thought that they would have mentioned this in the overview of his life, because this was very important. And obviously we will get to that. But yeah, I didn't know he was a founder of the Soil Association. Any thoughts on this, Max?
I didn't know he was the founder of the Soil Association. I know he had links with a lot of farming families, particularly in the Norfolk area. He did command a lot of support from people in, that were regarded as very respectable people and people that were very middle class and upper middle class. And so it's a great shame that he wasn't able to convert the support that he had into enough political clout to prevent himself from being imprisoned during the Second World War, and in order to enable him to prevent us from going to war, because one of the things as well was that he was anti-war. He didn't want to have a war with Germany. He didn't believe it was in Britain's interest to get involved in a war with Germany, and that was one of the reasons why he antagonised the establishment at that time.
Yeah, and it wasn't just him that was against the war either, was it? It was a lot of the people that actually fought in the First World War certainly didn't want to go back to war with Germany. There was a big movement to try and prevent the Second World War. And also this bit where he was supporting of organic farming, again, that was something that was involved with nationalism. You know, when you have the slogan blood and soil. So it was only natural that you would also not just be concerned about your own ethnic group, but you're also going to be concerned about the environment that your ethnic group is within. And we all love our country, all love the beauty that we have here within Britain of the countryside, and we want to preserve that. And instead of having a green party that is supportive of nationalism, we have a green party that is supposed to be concerned about the environment, but it's one of the biggest cheerleaders for mass immigration into Britain, and it doesn't appear to see any difference between the ethnicities at all. It's one of the ways that you can see that the Green Party, they're hypocrites, basically, because if you have white people, Europeans, they're concerned about the number of people that we have. Well, Europeans are not producing enough to replace ourselves. If you look at Europeans and you look at our farming practices, we have this organic farming, we take care of the environment. And then if you look at other people, say perhaps look at the Chinese, you look at how industrious they are, look at what they've actually done to China and the pollution in the Yangtze River, and they've killed off various species of dolphins and sea cow that they have over there, and the British people are very concerned about that, and as nationalists we're very concerned about our environment, and I think the Green Party are complete hypocrites as far as that is concerned, and it's just a communist front, don't you think, Max?
Oh, I think certainly the Green Party is very woke and very left wing, and certainly not something that we should subscribe to at all these days. And you're quite right in what you're saying, that the environmental movement had lots of roots going into nationalism and fascism during the middle to early part of the last century. One of the things that just springs to mind that Mosley was involved in, and that I think the British Union of Fascists was involved in, was campaigning against the Church of England's imposition of tithes on property that they own. Sometimes if you buy a house, even nowadays, you'll buy a house and you'll find that there will be written into the deeds of the house a requirement for the homeowner to pay a tithe to the church, to the local church. So if you buy a house that's near a church, particularly in a rural area, you might find that you're required to pay a tithe to the church. Now, sometimes the churches enforce it, sometimes the churches don't enforce it. But the point is that during the early part of the last century, there were large swathes of land, particularly in the Norfolk area. And this is why Mosley gained a bit of an association with a number of families in the Norfolk area, where the landowners were similarly required to pay a tithe to the church. And of course, if you've got quite a few acres of land, then the tithe actually mounts up to quite a considerable amount of money. And that then created a situation where lots of small farmers couldn't afford to manage their farms profitably, because the tithe was effectively taking all of the profit out of the work that they were doing and more besides. And they struggled to make ends meet. And so one of the things that the British Union of Fascists did during that time was to campaign against the imposition of the tithe in this way.
I think there was concern for animals as well, particularly if you look at the NSDP in Germany. They were the first to bring in laws against vivisection and to protect the animals. And I can recall seeing a piece of propaganda which had all the animals standing up and applauding. And then there was a picture of Hermann Göring there. I think he had an influence on this. And that would have been similar for these other nationalist movements. They showed concern for the farmers. They showed concern for the environment. And they also showed concern for the animals there. And then when we see today, you can contrast this. I saw an article the other day about the National Trust and they're destroying farms. They've been given farmland and they're wanting to turn it back over to rewild it. Farms where set for centuries people have worked doing up the dry stone walling and making it so that it's fit for livestock and fit for arable farming, and so that you have a system of providing for everything, growing enough grass so that you can feed the animals in the winter and all that sort of thing. And then you've got the National Trust that are getting rid of it. And then in Holland, you've got this big drive to get rid of all the farming there because they say that it's producing too much carbon dioxide. So they're trying to destroy a certain amount of farms in Holland, and that's probably going to come this way as well. And you just know that the Green Party are going to support this, and they're going to say, oh yes, well, we need to do this because of climate change, because of the carbon dioxide. We need to have less farmers. Whereas, if you contrast that back with these movements back then, Oswald Mosley's movement and the nationalist movements around Europe, they were very much concerned about farmers and caring about the farmers. And you can see here that he was one of the early founders of the Soil Association and the organic farming movement in Britain. And when you think of organic farmers today, you probably think of hippies. You probably don't think of nationalists at all. But you should think of nationalists, and we should be concerned about the environment, just not in the ways that we're being told today. Because, of course, the whole climate change thing is just a front to get all the governments working together underneath one large government. It's just communism in another guise. If they were genuinely concerned about the environment, they would be concerned about all these microplastics. They'd be concerned about this bisphenol A. They'd be concerned about the effect on our hormones from these hormone altering plastics that are out there, and all these different chemicals, all this estrogen that's in the environment. And we don't hear any of them talking about that. Instead, we hear them all supporting the agenda of diversity and climate change, and something as nationalists that I think we should capitalize on and talk about more about our concern for the environment. We need to get rid of this image that people have of us of hating other people. We don't. We love our own people. We want everybody to love their own people. And we're concerned about our environment. The environment that we have was built by our ancestors, going back thousands of years. If you look at Britain, you see all those beautiful hedgerows, all those patchwork of those green fields, and it all looks very, very natural. But originally it was all woodland. And our ancestors cut down the woodland, and we built these farms, and we built these enclosures, and we built the land up the way that it is today. It was our ancestors that built all that. And it's not that just by accident we happen to be born in this country and that's why it's ours. It's our country because it was our ancestors that shaped it. And that's why it looks so beautiful to us. You know, you often hear of these different ethnic groups, and they say, well, I don't feel welcome when I go into the country because there aren't so many of my sort of people in the country. Well, you wouldn't expect them to find the countryside as beautiful as the indigenous British do, because it's the indigenous British people's ancestors that shaped the countryside the way that it is, and they shaped it conforming to our beauty standards. Nobody is going to find the British countryside as beautiful as an indigenous Britain. And we are the ones that are really showing the concern for this. Of course, the government want to build up the green belt. They want to concrete over everything in order to build houses for the new people that are coming. And I should imagine you've also got the Green Party that are supporting that as well. But when you go back to this period, nationalist politics, as I say, it wasn't left, it wasn't right. It was just about doing what was best for the people and wanting the government to do what is best for the people. And that's when Mosley got disillusioned with the government, because he could see that they were not doing what is best for the people. And that's why he started off his new movement. Well, shall we go back to this time then that you're just talking about there, Max, when we were far more law-abiding, and talk about our greatest Britons?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk about Sir Oswald Ernold Mosley, 6th Baronet. Mosley was born on the 16th of November 1896 at 47 Hill Street, Mayfair, Westminster. He was the eldest of the three sons of Sir Oswald Mosley, 5th Baronet, and Catherine Maud Edwards Heathcote, daughter of Captain Justinian H. Edwards Heathcote of Apedale Hall, Staffordshire. He had two younger brothers, Edward Heathcote Mosley and John Arthur Noel Mosley. And the family traces its roots to Ernold de Moseley of Bushbury, Staffordshire, in the time of King John in the 12th century. The family was prominent in Staffordshire, and three baronetcies were created, two of which are now extinct. His five-time great-grandfather, John Parker Moseley, a Manchester hatter, was made a baronet in 1781, and his father was a third cousin to the 14th Earl of Strathmore and Kinghorn, the father of the future Queen Mother. So he was a distant relative of the Queen Mother, and I guess therefore the Queen as well. After Moseley's parents separated, he was raised by his mother, who went to live at Betton Hall near Market Drayton, and his paternal grandfather, Sir Oswald Moseley, 4th Baronet. Within the family and among intimate friends, he was always called Tom. He lived for many years at his grandparents' stately home, Apedale Hall, and was educated at West Downs School and Winchester College. He was a fencing champion in his school days, where he won titles in both foil and sabre, and he retained an enthusiasm for the sport throughout his life. So he was definitely upper class, I think we can say from that. And fencing, it's a great shame that fencing isn't such a prominent sport today as it was in years gone by. I think that that really gave a sense of being part of the earlier traditions and the earlier history of Britain. And obviously he had a great pedigree, I think, going all the way back to the time of King John. And I guess it would have been not very common to actually come from a broken home back then. That certainly wouldn't have been you would expect to see amongst the aristocracy and amongst the upper classes, I don't think. Or perhaps that they were the sort of people that would do this. But I would imagine that that was a very rare thing to happen. Although when we talked about Lawrence of Arabia, he came from a home that was a broken home, wasn't it? And they weren't married. So perhaps that was something the aristocracy did. I mean, I'm just looking at it today, and it's looked at as something that probably happens more with the lower classes. But perhaps back then it was the upper classes. And also, as you'll see later on in this, he was a womanizer, which was a great shameful thing, really, for him to have been a womanizer, but he was. And perhaps the fact that he came from a broken home might have had an influence on that in his later life, and he wasn't able to remain with one person, because the example that he'd been given when he was a child was his parents splitting up. So perhaps that may have had an influence on him later in life. Any thoughts on this early point in Oswald Moseley's life, Max?
No, I don't think there's anything I'd like to sort of, there's no sort of like firm assertions that I'd like to make. I think that marriage breakups have occurred as a generalism within our society. The breakup of a marriage is a far more common thing now than it used to be in the past. I would think that probably in the early part of the last century, it was a more common thing amongst the wealthy, because the wealthy would have the money to make it work, so that children didn't then, as a result of the breakup of a marriage, become destitute. The parents would separate in such a way that both of them would be wealthy enough to continue to raise the children in the manner to which they'd become accustomed. So there probably was divorce and broken marriages were probably facilitated by wealth in those days, in the same way that they're probably facilitated by wealth nowadays. It's just that as far as the vast majority of the population are concerned, most of whom would have been too poor to sustain a marriage breakup without there being economic hardship following.
Yeah, that's a good point, that. And also, there was no welfare system then. If you did come from a broken home, you weren't going to get benefits and a house provided and all the rest of it. You're probably going to end up in a workhouse right back there at the turn of the century. Well, in January 1914, Moseley entered the Royal Military College, Sandhurst. And Wikipedia says he was expelled in June for a riotous act of retaliation against a fellow student. However, there was no mention of this at all in Moseley's own autobiography. He had a fight early on at the school, but remained at the school until the outbreak of war. Indeed, he goes through his training there before heading off to Dublin. So I found that quite surprising. Apparently this allegation that he was expelled comes from an anti-nationalist book, an anti-right-wing book. I mean, I forget what the title is, but it's quite obvious that it's an anti-right-wing book. So I have a suspicion that that was just put in there to smear him, because he does talk about having this little fight at the beginning, but that actually makes him look good in the eyes of the rest of the school rather than being expelled. And if he was expelled, surely you would expect to find proof of that. Looking at it online, nobody's able to actually find the proof of it at all anywhere. It's just talked about in this one anti-nationalist book. So that was the first instance that I found in Wikipedia trying to smear him. As I say, I did think that these allegations about him having these different women, I thought, well, maybe that was smearing him as well. But I spoke to Laura Towler about that, who is a big fan of Oswald Mosley, and she said, no, sadly, it does appear that that was truthful. And he was a womaniser. Well, during the First World War, he was commissioned into the British Cavalry Unit, the 16th of the Queen's Lancers, and he fought in France on the Western Front. He transferred to the Royal Flying Corps as an observer, but while demonstrating in front of his mother and sister, he crashed, which left him with a permanent limp, as well as a reputation, though, for being brave and somewhat reckless. But he returned to the trenches before the injury had fully healed, and at the Battle of Loos in 1915 passed out at his post from the pain, and he spent the remainder of the war at desk jobs in the Ministry of Munitions and in the Foreign Office. Now, this is interesting. It gives you an insight into what the people were like back then, desperate to get back out there and fight. And yet he's in so much pain, he ends up passing out at his post. And this also shows us that even though he was part of the aristocracy, he was literally in the trenches, fighting in the trenches. And we're taught to think that that didn't actually happen for the aristocracy. They were all the donkeys that were leading the lions, as it were. So it shows that he would have had a real dislike of war. And the people that were involved in that First World War, they certainly didn't want to see Britain going to war again against Germany in the Second World War. We'll get to that later on. Any comments on this, Max?
Well, there's a book written by somebody whose first name eludes me, but I think his surname was Star Jordan, who talks about the deaths during the First World War. And he describes the situation in in addition to people being generally conscripted, there were also volunteer groups that were created, very often of footballers and other sports people. But also there were, I think there was a division that was made up of students from Oxford and Cambridge. And I think it consisted of something like 3,000 men who all went off to war, and only about 300 of them came back. And so, you know, that was a an example, because the children, the young people that would have gone to Oxford and Cambridge in those days would have tended to have been from the richer sort of 10% or so of the population. And you know, they lost nearly 3,000 sons as a result of that.
Yeah, it's an absolute tragedy. But of course, they were very patriotic, and they wanted to go to war. They wanted to defend their countries. And remember when we talked about Rudyard Kipling, and he was very gung-ho and was a propagandist for the war until his son lost his life fighting in that war. So you can see that a lot of people would have been very, very against going to war again. But by the end of the First World War, Mosley had decided to go into politics as a Conservative Member of Parliament. As he had no university education or practical experience because of the war, he was 21 years old. So I guess that must have interrupted his education there, where he went off to war. How long did the war last? 4 years. So he must have gone in there when he was about 16. He was 21 years old here. He was driven by and in Parliament spoke of a passionate conviction to avoid any future war. And this seemingly motivated his career. And as we say, that stuck with him. And along with a lot of others as well, that really didn't want to see a Second World War. Largely because of his family background and war service, local Conservative and Labour associations preferred Mosley in several constituencies. A vacancy near the family estates seemed to be the best prospect, but he was unexpectedly selected for Harrow first, and in the general election of 1918 he faced no serious opposition and was elected easily. He was the youngest member of the House of Commons to take his seat, although Joseph Sweeney, an abstentionist Sinn Féin member, was younger. He soon distinguished himself as an orator and political player, one marked by extreme self-confidence, and made a point of speaking in the House of Commons without notes. Mosley was an early supporter of the economist John Maynard Keynes, with the economic historian Robert Skidelsky describing Mosley as a disciple of Keynes in the 1920s. So he was known to be a great speaker, rather like Enoch Powell there, and he notably spoke without notes. So it must have been just a general stream of consciousness, and he must have been very good at that. Now, I don't know much about economics, Max, but I have heard of Keynesian economics. So what is being inferred here by Mosley being a supporter of Keynes?
It's more a matter that instead of being a strict monetarist, he would have adopted a more sort of pragmatic approach to the financial affairs of the country. Would have been more prone to do things like borrowing in order to invest in industry, in order to create more jobs. It's a matter of Keynes tended to, or his ideas were all around making money more available and travel faster around the economy in order to stimulate investment growth, economic growth.
So pump the money in there, get the industry going. That's going to create the jobs. Then you got more money there for the people that are being paid, so that they can pay for the products. And we'll see later on, Mosley's ideas were actually, you know, very, very commended, and they were used by John Major, of all people. And we'll talk about
Keynesianism is the opposite of the sort of austerity that hardline conservatives have tended to advocate. You know, when the country runs into economic problems, they advocate austerity, whereas Keynes would have advocated would have thought out of the box, really, and would have advocated something that would be likely to stimulate economic growth rather than just reduce inflation, for example, by imposing strict austerity.
Well, I guess this would be why he ended up then moving over to Labour, because he was conservative at this time when he was supporting Keynes. Well, moving on to his marriage next to Lady Cynthia Curzon. On the 11th of May 1920, he married Lady Cynthia, or Kimmy Curzon, who lived from 1898 to 1933, the second daughter of the first Earl Curzon of Kedleston, Viceroy of India, 1899 to 1905. He was also the Foreign Secretary from 1919 to 24, and Lord Curzon's first wife was the US mercantile heiress Mary Leiter. So he's marrying into a family, I would say, that's probably about a similar level to his own. Lord Curzon had to be persuaded that Mosley was a suitable husband, as he suspected that Mosley was largely motivated by social advancement in Conservative Party politics and Cynthia's inheritance. The 1920 wedding took place in the Chapel Royal in St James's Palace in London, and the hundreds of guests included King George V and Queen Mary, as well as foreign royalty such as the Duke and Duchess of Brabant, the later King Leopold III, and Queen Astrid of Belgium. So a very, very aristocratic affair there. During this marriage, he began an extended affair with his wife's younger sister, Lady Alexandra Metcalfe, and a separate affair with their stepmother, Grace Curzon, Marchioness Curzon of Kedleston, the American-born second wife and widow of Lord Curzon of Kedleston. And that's what I thought there. There may have been some attempt to smearing him. That's why they were saying this. But, I mean, that's really bad behaviour, having an affair with his wife's younger sister and then a separate affair with their stepmother. It does seem that he has this weakness, really, for adultery. I'm just very, very sad to see this. It really does blot his copybook, I think. What do you make of this, Max?
Well, you could look at it that way. I suppose what it demonstrates is that he was a passionate man, not just passionate about politics, but passionate in every other respect as well. And this was a less welcome manifestation of his predisposition for passion.
Well, it may have been that these women were seducing him as well. You know, it may have been that he just didn't have the willpower to resist, and perhaps he should never have been married to Cynthia in the first place. And her father was actually correct, and maybe he was largely motivated by social advancement and Cynthia's inheritance, and maybe that explained the reason why he started to having these affairs with other women at the time. Well, Moseley was at this time falling out with the Conservatives over its Irish policy. That's interesting because he moved to Ireland in his later life, and he condemned the operations of the Black and Tans against civilians during the Irish War of Independence. And I think the Black and Tans had something to do with Winston Churchill, I seem to recall. We did talk about them in Truth Without Radio, myself and Dennis Wise, in one of the episodes that we did about Ireland. Moseley was Secretary of the Peace with Ireland Council, and as Secretary of the Council, he proposed sending a commission to Ireland to examine on-the-spot reprisals by the Black and Tans, because they did have a very bad reputation for just attacking people and being completely lawless, basically. In late 1920, he crossed the floor to sit as an independent MP on the opposition side of the House of Commons. Having built up a following in his constituency, he retained it against a Conservative challenge in 1922 and the 1923 general elections. So he's been independent now, and he's also been Conservative. And the liberal Westminster Gazette would write that Moseley was the most polished literary speaker in the Commons. Words flow from him in graceful epigrammatic phrases that have a sting in them for the government and the Conservatives. To listen to him is an education in the English language, also in the art of delicate but deadly repartee. He has human sympathies, courage, and brains. So, I mean, he was obviously must have been a fantastic speaker. I think it's a great shame we don't have more recordings of his speeches, or it may be that his estate have kept a hold of them and don't want them to be put on YouTube or published anywhere, because we have lots of copies of the text, but we don't have many copies of the speeches. And I find this surprising, because he was all for modern technology. I think the first picture disc may have been something that was put out with Oswald Moseley on it of one of his speeches. So I do find it very surprising that we don't have more of his speeches, because he was so into modern technology. That was a big part of his platform.
I think Oswald Moseley was a man very similar in his oratory to Jonathan Bowden. And Jonathan Bowden was, and I obviously never saw Moseley speak live, although I've seen the odd bits of film of him in the middle of a speech. But Jonathan Bowden's style of speaking wasn't, he didn't ape what Moseley used to do, but he had the same ability to just talk. You know, I've seen him stand and talk for an hour and a half with no notes, and never repeat himself, and to make one cogent argument flow logically into the next cogent argument, into the next, and have people grip for that entire hour and a half, and then sort of deliver the sort of final part of the speech as a sort of emotive crescendo. I suspect from what I've read that Moseley was of a very similar sort.
So there we go. We used to have somebody that was able to do this similar thing. So it must have been quite incredible and moving to see him speak. And they're saying here he was the very best at speaking in the House of Commons, is effectively what they're saying here. And by 1924, he was growing increasingly attracted to the Labour Party, which had just formed a government. And in March, he joined it. He immediately joined the Independent Labour Party as well and allied himself with the left. And I think the Independent Labour Party was a part of the Labour Party, even though it says independent. When the government fell in October, Moseley had to choose a new seat. as he believed that Harrow would not re-elect him as a Labour candidate. He therefore decided to oppose Neville Chamberlain in Birmingham Ladywood. Mosley campaigned aggressively in Ladywood and accused Chamberlain of being a landlord's hireling. The outraged Chamberlain demanded that Mosley retract the claim as a gentleman. But Mosley refused to retract the allegation, and he was noted for bringing excitement and energy to the campaign. And he lost that campaign by a very, very small amount of votes. We'll get to that in a bit. But I just find it interesting here that he's actually going up against Chamberlain. And the main point that Mosley has, the main driving part of his character, is that he didn't want there to be a Second World War. And Chamberlain was the one that was actually trying to prevent there being a Second World War. So surprising that he goes up against him. And as we'll see here, surprising that he only lost by such a small amount. Leslie Hoare-Belisha, a senior Conservative, recorded his impressions of Mosley as a platform orator at this time, claiming that his dark, aquiline, flashing, tall, thin, assured, defiance in his eye and contempt in his forward chin. Together, Oswald and Cynthia Mosley proved an alluring couple, and many members of the working class in Birmingham supported them, and the historian Martin Pugh has suggested that a link with powerful, wealthy and glamorous men and women appealed strongly to those who endured humdrum and deprived lives. And we saw the same thing with Enoch Powell. We've also seen the same thing with Donald Trump, where the working class get behind somebody who is powerful, wealthy and glamorous, who they believe understands the position they're in. The left tells us that that they can't possibly understand the situation that the lower classes are in because they're not lower class. But throughout the earlier years, we had this noblesse oblige, where the nobles were obliged to look out for those under them, basically. And Professor Edward Dutton has pointed out that the top parts of the nobles and the aristocracy, they would be beaten at school in order to get them to understand what it was like to be less well off, and they were very, very badly treated to get them to have this sympathy with the lower classes. So he was one of these noble types, these aristocratic types, that was able to get the support from the working classes as well. Getting back to the count here, it took several recounts before Chamberlain was eventually declared the winner by just 77 votes. And Mosley blamed poor weather for the result. And that's a great shame, because I guess that means that we could have ended up with Mosley as Prime Minister if he hadn't have lost this. His period outside Parliament was used to develop a new economic policy for the Independent Labour Party, which eventually became known as the Birmingham Proposals, and they continued to form the basis of Mosley's economics until the end of his political career. And I'll just stop there, Max. Any thoughts on him losing to Neville Chamberlain here by 77 votes?
Yeah, it wasn't something I was aware of until you had sort of first told me about it. But I suppose it isn't strange that he stood against Chamberlain, because it would have enhanced his reputation to have done that, particularly as they'd had heated exchanges. And, you know, one of the ways of winning support, one of the way is to create publicity. And in those days, in the absence of televisions, etc., a way to generate publicity would be to have very sort of furious arguments with your political opponents that would rouse people and summon up the blood, etc. And that was all part of his charisma.
Yeah, well, I think that sort of added to it, wasn't it? I mean, that was why he didn't really apologise for this, because it must have drawn attention to it, to see him both having this argument. And there's this great description there here of him speaking as well. And I guess you don't really see descriptions like that of people talking now. I think they were far more descriptive back then, because they weren't used to seeing so many pictures and videos, film and all the sort of thing that we have now. That they were used to be very descriptive about somebody's character. Well, Mosley was critical of Winston Churchill's policy as Chancellor of the Exchequer, and Churchill was also responsible for sending the Black and Tans into Ireland. After Churchill returned Britain to the gold standard, Mosley claimed that, faced with the alternative of saying goodbye to the gold standard, and therefore to his own employment, and goodbye to other people's employment, Mr. Churchill characteristically selected the latter course. And of course, leaving the gold standard, we have left the gold standard now, but back then this was a very important thing. And I can recall seeing a quote from Churchill saying that if Adolf Hitler had not left the gold standard, this war would not be happening. So it was quite important to them at the time that they stuck with the gold standard. And it seems here that Mosley approved of this. I think that's what it's saying here. Any thoughts, Max?
I'm not sure. So I'm just trying to sort of read back through that statement again. Could you just read that to me again, that faced with the alternative of saying goodbye to the gold standard and therefore to his own employment and goodbye to other people's employment, Mr. Churchill characteristically selected the latter course. So Churchill supported the course of action that would kiss goodbye to other people's employment, which I believe was probably sticking with the gold standard. The gold standard would have created a restricted kind of economics, which would have been the opposite of Keynesian. Keynes wouldn't have been an advocate of the gold standard, I don't think. Keynes would have been an advocate of fiat money being used in order to stimulate the economy.
Yeah, well, it looks here as if he's saying that if Churchill had said goodbye to the gold standard, he would have been saying goodbye to other people's employment as well. And Churchill selected the latter course. It's a very confusing quote, isn't it? Saying that he's faced with the alternative of saying goodbye to the gold standard. And then it says that he chose the latter course. So I guess therefore he stayed with the gold standard. And what Mosley is saying is that if he'd left the gold standard, then that would have been goodbye to other people's employment. So it seems as if he's actually commending Churchill for doing the right thing.
No. Sticking with the gold standard would kiss goodbye to other people's jobs, because the gold standard restricted the money supply so that only people who had gold had economic power. Breaking away from the gold standard was something which released us from that restriction.
Right.
If you can imagine an economy where there is only a set amount of money and there can never be more money, as the population grows, it means that money's got to be distributed between less and less people. So on average, people are going to become poorer. Whereas if you can have an economy where you can create money as fiat money, then which is what the Germans did during the Third Reich, then you can stimulate the economy, which is what the Germans did, and went from a situation where they had runaway inflation and very high unemployment to a situation where they then had an economy that was strong enough for Germany to then fight a five-year-long war against most of the other major powers of the world. Sort of demonstrates that breaking away from the gold standard actually was a stimulant to the economy and would have obviously saved people's jobs, whereas sticking with the gold standard would have restricted economic growth economic growth would have been a much slower affair, and lots of people would have lost their jobs.
Yeah, well, it would have been limited by the amount of gold that you could find and all the work that goes into getting the gold in the first place as well. Whereas if you can just create the money when it's needed, that saves all of that, doesn't it? And you're not limited then by the amount that you have, as you say, Max.
And I think sticking with the gold standard is one of the factors that caused the Wall Street crash.
Thank you very much for listening, and do check out the Greatest Britain's Archive at radioalbion.com for more in our series on our Greatest Britons.